I appreciate Brother Lynn's singing tonight. And he did something very important, and that is before the lesson, the song before the lesson, he asked us all to stand. And at home, that's sort of a theme, because Tony likes to stand in the song right before the lesson. It helps me to get everything flowing, to be able to stand before I do that. And so I appreciate that. And Lynn pointed out something else, and that is because of the work of Brother Schnabel, Auburn is now a more spiritual university than Alabama. And I put that in because Lynn's an Alabama fan. So we all know Auburn's more spiritual, and that's why Brother Schnabel was there. Well, it's good to see all of you tonight. For those of you who are visiting, who have come, we really appreciate your presence in our midst. It's good that I was able to be here after Michaela was continually trying to ram us today as we were on the Current River. Everybody was asking us about our canoe trip today. And yes, we survived Michaela ramming us. And we're here tonight. So all is well. And we had a beautiful day outdoors. Looking forward to this series of lessons. It was mentioned that they're available through live stream, I guess, Zoom. In fact, a preacher friend of mine from Georgia listened in last night, texted me about that through the game we play called Words with Friends. And he said he watched last night's sermon. So and a young man, Ninus, was telling me that her son was listening to the sermon ahead of time, too. So it's really valuable that we can do that and have it broadcast that way. All right, tonight, I want to ask you if you feel like here in Missouri, wherever it is, whatever township you live in, whatever city you might live in, do you feel as if you are living the dream? And I'm here to tell you that whatever you might conceive of that to be, maybe it's your dream house in a dream location, and whether or not you've achieved all of that that you might have envisioned in your life, I'm here to tell you tonight that you can live the dream wherever you are. Because ultimately in this life, living the dream is learning to live life in the presence of God, walking daily, humbly, with your King. And that's what I want to enhance and encourage with you this week. This lesson tonight might be the most important one that I present in this series of lessons, as it focuses on this goal, your walk daily, humbly, with the King. I preached another sermon that was somewhat of a companion of this idea back at home in Decker Prairie, Tomball, outside of Houston. And it was called The Missing Sermon. And when I talked about the missing sermon, I wasn't talking about a sermon that was lost or one of thousands in my files that I couldn't put my hand on. It was a sermon that I wished I had heard when I was a young person. And then I qualified by saying perhaps someone preached it, because I heard a lot of great preaching growing up, a lot of men who preached and preached well. Perhaps they did preach it and I just didn't get it. And so I want to make sure that the audiences that I preach to get it. And that is the importance of walking daily humbly with the King. And I want to tell you about this particular lesson. When I preached it at Decker Prairie less than 2 years ago, I thought immediately I needed to take this on the road with me. And so the first time I tried that out was in Louisville, Kentucky in March of 2019. And one of the brothers there that I've known for a very long time, his wife and I attended at Florida College at the same time along with Della. And he told me, you need to preach that wherever you go. And so, again, if this doesn't work out tonight, not only do you get to blame Mike and Carol for introducing me to you as a group, but also to blame him as well for suggesting that I preach this particular lesson. But I tell you that to say, I had dinner that night before preaching this lesson with a delightful older sister and her son in the congregation there at Manslick Road in Louisville. And what was so interesting about this lady is she was very spry and spunky, and she was 93 years old. And what else I remember about her is her name, because I had never met anybody with her name. And her name is Captola. Captola would be 94 now. And she's on YouTube. And so if you want to check her out tonight, if you have access to YouTube, and I know all the young people do, you can see Captola as she explains how to iron a shirt. Because Captola was concerned that a lot of young people are growing up and they don't know how to iron. And so if you look up Captola, C-A-P-T-O-L-A, how to iron a shirt, her video will pop up where she explains to you as a young person the art of ironing. You need to know how to iron. And she even has one how to clean out a dryer vent. But I haven't found that one yet. But supposedly it's on YouTube somewhere. Maybe it's being censored like everything else and you can't find it anymore on YouTube. I don't know. My sermons have been censored. That's another story. But I must tell you, after preaching that lesson, Captola comes out into the foyer and shakes my hand and looks up into my eyes and sincerely says to me, I needed that sermon. Now, as someone who's been a saint for as long as Captola has been, for her to come up to me and say, I needed that sermon, and she still saw herself as needing to grow more into the likeness of Christ and learning more about communion with Him in her daily life, that's impressive. And so hopefully tonight's lesson will help you in the same way. It's that important to me that you listen carefully and see if it can help you to know the Lord better, to depend upon Him more, to have a richer, deeper fellowship with Him. I read three books early on as a gospel preacher in the early 80s, and I'm sure Lynn's read at least one of these, if not two or all of them. Three books that really changed my understanding and perception of things. One is a classic work by J.I. Packer called Knowing God. Another is a book written by George W. Otis, The God They Never Knew, The Tragedy of Religion Without Relationship. And maybe the title was better than a lot of the content of the book, but it still had a lot of great things to say about the real tragedy that people experience who have some connection or association with God, but really don't experience the kind of relationship with Him that the Scriptures really describe. The tragedy of religion without relationship. And certainly that would describe the Pharisees that I've already talked about in this series of lessons. The other is a really tiny book written by J.B. Phillips. And I'm not an avid reader, so the shorter the better for me. And this is a really tiny little paperback by J.B. Phillips, and it's entitled, Your God is Too Small. And when I read that little work, I realized that my God was too small. And so if I can do something tonight to enhance your perception of God, that's what I want to do. And I want to do it from perhaps a very familiar psalm, Psalm 139. It is an extraordinary psalm of David that attracts many students of the Bible. Derek Kidner, one of my favorite authors of the Psalms, and I've mentioned him already. Again, he says things very briefly and concisely, but powerfully. Says of Psalm 139 in his commentary that any small thoughts of God are magnificently transcended by this psalm. Yet for all of its height and depth, it remains intensely personal from first to last. This is about David's relationship with God. And you might remember how this psalm begins with some wonderful things about the knowledge of God. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. I think sometimes we don't have a perception of that like we need to. When you came into this building and you sat down, God knew all about that. And when I finally get done preaching and you get up, He will know all about that as well. And He always does. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, Thou dost know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid Your hand on me. May He lay His hand on us. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it. And so this speaks to the knowledge of God, or as we say in a very big word, His omniscience, or that He is all-knowing. But David is not stating this from a theological perspective or to make a theological point. This is intensely personal, as we suggested. This is a confession of his adoration for God. It is the knowledge of God that is personal and active. It discerns us. The knowledge of God sifts us and handles us and knows us better than we know ourselves. And such knowledge lends itself to God's omnipresence. That God has an ability to attend to every place. He is all present. It doesn't mean that God is everywhere in the sense that I swipe my hand and I'm somehow touching God. It is that I cannot flee from God. We must avoid that age-old impulse to try to get away from God and from His rule and from His sovereign hand, because that's futile. And yes, Jonah teaches us that. How far are you going to run to get away from God? What a foolish thing to attempt to even try. Even if I could go into heaven or the remotest parts of the earth, you can go up into the sky to the space station. Isn't it cool when you look up, and you've done this, right? You look up into the sky, what is that? That's not a star. That really big thing in the sky that's so bright, it's the space station. Dell and I go for a walk almost every night, and the first thing I'll do, I'll look up, there's a space station. Glowing in the sky. But even if you could go all the way to the space station, and very far beyond that, you could travel in space all of your days, and not get to Pluto, but you could not escape God. Even there, your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. Surely the darkness will overwhelm me, I say, and the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is not dark to thee, and the night is as bright as the day. It doesn't matter where you go, day or night, God is intimately aware of you and all that you're about. And I've been sometimes puzzled at what follows as he goes on to describe the creation of an individual in the womb and how wonderful that is.
And so it actually flows out of God's ability, His wisdom and His knowledge, that He is able to fashion with His all-creative power something so wonderful as the human frame. And the fact that He knows everything about all of our days. In your book, they were all written. The days that were ordained for me, but as yet there was not one of them. And that overwhelms David. We said yesterday morning from Psalm 31, David saying, "My times are in your hand." When will be your last day? When you breathe your last, God knows precisely the time. He knows your days. And He is well aware of our circumstances and the threats to our lives. And He is intimately involved in the lives of His people. So I don't have to fret about that. I don't have to get caught up in excessive anxiety about that. And so as he considers these thoughts about God, I want you to focus with me tonight on verses 17 and 18. When he says, "How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them." And there's some question as to whether he's talking about the thoughts of God, which know no limits, and how vast the sum of those are. Or even his thoughts about God, or all of our thoughts about God, and how incredible or vast they are. Either way, they're extraordinary. And he says, if I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. And then he says, when I am away, may have noticed that's the title of tonight's lesson. When I awake, I am still with you. I read that a couple years ago and I said to myself, I've never really thought about that statement much. When I awake, I'm still with you. And then I said, oh, that's a little bit of nightmare. Because there are some mornings that I awake, and my first thought is not God. It's not His presence. It is not my relationship with Him. And that I should live my life in view of Him. And yet that's the way David lived. The first thought on his mind when he awoke was his awesome God. And so as I thought about that, I said, how did he get there? We all know he is the man after God's heart from Acts 13. Doesn't mean that he was sinlessly perfect. We know something about that as well, but characteristically, in David's life, he was a man of devotion and worship and had a relationship with God even in the midst of great and horrible trials. And he writes about that in the Psalms, even in his darkest days, even at times where he says, no one cares for my soul. He affirms his trust in God. As we said yesterday, though the earth should change, he would believe. And so I thought about what must have gone through David's mind, and how can I, like David, more consistently, and that's what I want to promote, more consistently have God as my first thought when I awake. I preached another lesson called First Impulse at around the same time. And when you're going through trial and difficulty, when some unforeseen thing happens that is negative, that might cause anxiety or concern, or when some great news comes your way and it is a moment of elation and rejoicing, is it your first impulse to go to God about that thing? To either thank Him for the wonderful thing that has happened, or to say, God, I need You in this moment, in this trial. The person who has God as his or her first thought when he or she awakens will be more likely to do that. The person who does this, we could say, is godly. You ask somebody in the Bible class, you ask this question, is what does it mean to be godly? And we have a neat little thing that we say when that question arises. What does it mean to be godly? Somebody raises it. It means be godlike. That sounds like godly. And that's right. A godly person is godlike. But I really don't think that's the best definition of godliness. If we were going to ask, what does it mean to be worldly? Well, you might raise your hand and say, well, that means that you are worldlike. But nobody ever says that. But you are. If you're worldly, you're like the world. You're worldlike. But you would say someone that is worldly has their heart trained and focused on the world. And that's right. The person who is godly has his or her heart trained or focused on God. You're not a godly person merely because you're pretty good at attending assemblies. I get 3 a week, 3 check marks. Gospel meeting, get a few extra check marks. But then, how many thoughts of God beyond the four walls of this building are there? You see, a godly person is thinking about God on a more regular basis. It is a beneficial and awesome thing in our lives to live godly. And that means that we focus, as David did throughout the Psalms, to focus on the person of God. Think about Him, all of the qualities that make Him sovereign and unique in existence. And then to know, not just because of His person, the works that He does, the promises that He offers, the help that He renders, and realize our need for Him. When I awake, I am still with You. I got this little picture off of Google Images. That's where I find some stuff to put on my slides. And I preached this about 3 times before somebody said, well, that's a neat picture, but the verse is wrong. I got it right on the previous slide. It's actually, isn't it neat how you can fix that? It's actually verse 18, not verse 17, but it's still a great picture. So I'm going to use it. How did David get there? When I awake, I'm still with You. 3 quick things, and then I'll be done. David didn't get here by accident. David got to the point where when he awoke, he was still with God as a result of spiritual training. We see evidence of his spiritual training as a young man. He would have had to be involved in some spiritual development, or he would not have been at the moment of his selection to be the next king. When Samuel the prophet comes to his house and asks Jesse to bring in his sons, and he says, God does not look on the outward appearance, but looks upon the heart. David has already developed a heart that is godly when he is selected. Wonder where that came from. Remember the young man Timothy that was so important in Paul's work as an evangelist and what he says about Timothy. He says, you know the sacred scriptures from your youth that are able to make you wise unto salvation. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And so how did Timothy learn those scriptures from his youth? We learned earlier in 2 Timothy chapter 1 that it was because of the faithful influence of a grandmother, Lois, and a mother, Eunice, who had instilled those truths in him. The spiritual training in Timothy's life made a huge impact on him that helped to equip him to be one of proven character and worth to the Apostle Paul. And to be so employed so nobly in God's cause. And so I always say, those of you who are involved in training your children and grandchildren, as we talked about training children last night, it is an important task. It is perhaps a world-changing task to do that work. So who were the godly parents of David? Well, we know his dad's name, right? His dad's name was Jesse. Extra credit if you know what David's mother's name was. Well, this is where Bible trivia gets a little more challenging. The name of David's mother. Well, you can word it out. Anybody know David's mother? She's mentioned in Scripture a couple of times. She came to David along with Jesse in 1 Samuel chapter 22 as he's on the run. She's actually mentioned in the Psalms. In Psalm 86 and verse 16, when David says, "Turn to me and have mercy on me. Show your strength in behalf of your servant. Save me because I serve you just as my mother did." That's the New International Version of Psalm 86:16. My version, the New American Standard, says, "Save the son of your handmaid." And so he talks about his mother's relationship to God. Actually, the Bible doesn't tell us her name. But the Jewish Talmud says that her name was Nitzavet. Hard to pull that out of the hat, huh? And maybe that's why it's not recorded in Scripture. I don't know. Nitzavet, according to the Jewish Talmud. It wasn't just some happenstance that he just happened to have the right genetic package that led him to be the man after God's own heart. It was cultivated, and more on that in a moment. It wasn't just about his spiritual training, but that was involved. But number two, I want to suggest to you that David got to this place of godliness where his first thought when he awoke was God. Because there were constant assurances of God's presence in his life. Just think about some of the incidents that happened in David's life that involve God's presence or attendance. You have a prophet that comes to your house, and Jesse starts parading sons 1 through 7 before the prophet, and he says, "Oh, surely Eliab, the oldest, he looks the part of a king. Surely he's the one." And Samuel says, not him. Oh, maybe Abinadab and Shema, sons 2 and 3. And all the way down through son number 7. And Samuel's going, "Nope, not him, not him, not him, not him. Oh, I got one more. Bring him in from the sheepfold. He's the one." Anointed to be the next king of Israel. And then the incident unfolds in the next chapter. That giant Philistine who is haunting the armies of the living God. Oh, his older brothers were there, but they weren't going out to fight the giant Philistine. King Saul was there, but he wasn't going to fight the giant Philistine. Got to wonder about that. And I've always wondered where Jonathan is. Certainly he would have had the courage and faith to take on the giant, but he's not even mentioned in the story, so I'm not sure what happened with Jonathan on that occasion. But David says, the God who delivered me from the lion and the bear who threatened my sheep will deliver this Philistine into my hand. And he faces this giant on the battlefield with the full assurance that God was going to deliver him into his hand, and he goes onto that battlefield with a sling and a few stones. Yes, he was proficient. But when he hurled that stone, now there were those in Israel who could hurl at a hair's breadth and not miss. I mean, they were accurate. I'm pretty sure David had a lot of experience with that. I mean, I was skipping some rocks today. We had a little contest, a rock skipping contest. None of us were really good. It had been so long since I had skipped a rock, I had a hard time getting going. I wasn't very accurate. I wasn't very proficient. But David is very proficient with the sling. But don't think for a second that that rock that was slung was not aided by the providence of God as it sank deep into the forehead of that giant. And David ran up to that giant that fell. Can you imagine the earthquake that took place when that massive man fell to the ground? And David took his own sword, the sword of the giant, and lopped off his head. This is that giant. That sort of invigorated the armies of Israel, didn't it? Do you think David had a sense on that occasion of the presence and favor of God in his life? What about all the times he escaped from the hand of Saul? Even the time when he goes in and there is Saul right before him in the cave. He has the ability to kill him, but he will not put forth his hand against the Lord's anointed. He sees the hand of God. He knows he's going to be the next king. In 1 Samuel 30, when his family is taken captive and the city of Ziklag is burned, he makes an appeal to God through the priest. What do I need to do? And God says, you go after your family and you'll not lose one of them. And that's exactly what happens. What do you think? David stands around and goes, well, I don't know if I really believe in God. I'm not sure if he's really there. No, he's there. And not only does he know he's there, the people know that God is with him. When Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, tries to establish the kingdom under his rule, the people say, God's anointed you. They understand he is going to be the next king. The Uzzah incident, do you think he doesn't realize the very real presence of God? And then there was the matter of Bathsheba and the prophet of God. So often it was Nathan and Gad who would come and speak God's word to David. And on that occasion, Nathan comes to him and tells the story about the one little ewe lamb and says, you're the man in this story. And then everything that he is told about the consequences of those actions come true throughout his life. There was never any question. In David's mind, about the presence of God. God had been real to David his whole life. And I wonder if God is that real to us. If we have the same confidence and assurance. Because if we did, we might be more likely to have him as our first thought when we awake. One more thought. And that is, David practiced devotion. His shepherd reflections. Like Psalm 23, that favorite psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He leads me into green pastures and leads me beside still waters. confidence expressed in devotion. I was glad. He was constantly about worship. I was glad when they said unto me, let us go to the house of the Lord. Psalm 122 and verse 1. If God is banished from your thoughts the moment you leave the building and He doesn't return until you come back into the building, the result will not be godliness. I don't know who developed the idea of praying before meals, but it was a wonderful thing. My parents instilled that in me. At mealtime, we pray. We thank God for the blessings of the meals that we were eating. You know, groceries are pretty easy to come by. I guess even if you don't have a lot of money. I mean, there are grocery stores everywhere in every corner. 5 to 10 minutes, most of us can be in a grocery store to get the food. And we've got credit cards. We can buy food in abundance to eat. And so we really struggle to grasp the concept of give us this day our daily bread. But do we have a sense of all the provision that God has given us? We have such abundant blessing. We struggle to appreciate it until something happens and food disappears from the shelf. Now we have this when hurricanes come to Houston. We experience it. All of a sudden the shelves are empty because there's a run on food. Or if you have a coronavirus, there's a run on toilet paper and bullets. And I'm not really sure why those two things go together. But in Houston, we ran out of toilet paper and bullets. Now we have toilet paper, but the bullets are still low. I think we're expecting war. I don't know. But sometimes things aren't on the shelf that you're used to being there. Or if there's some kind of lettuce contamination, all of a sudden you can't get romaine. Where's the romaine? It's gone. I'm telling you, one of these days it's going to happen. The food supply is going to be cut off for whatever reason. And we're going to go, oh no, where's the food? There was a meat shortage for a while this year. A meat shortage. Are we thankful for the provisions of each day? Do you give thanks for your food? It's a good place to start regular communion. At least 3 times a day, if you're eating that many meals, to acknowledge God's blessing. You know, we don't always pray over all the food we eat. Who knows that? Do you ever eat popcorn at night? Watch a movie, watch a sporting event. Hey, let's pop some popcorn. Hey, we'll have some ice cream. Do you ever pray before you eat your popcorn? We don't tend to do that. That's not part of the tradition. And I'm not saying you should absolutely pray for your popcorn, but wouldn't be a bad thing to do that. Or just to privately acknowledge, God, I know you're there. Thank you for all that you do. I need you. Just like David needed you. I wonder if David was able to say, when I awake, I'm still with you. Because his last thought of every day was the God whom he served. And if he was your last thought of the day, he might be more likely to be your first thought of the day. And so what am I hoping to accomplish? What seemed to help Captola last year, what will be your first thought when you awake tomorrow? I think this is about the 7th or 8th time I've preached this lesson now, and I'll tell you, I need to keep hearing it. I don't know how many times Della is going to get to listen to this sermon, but I need to keep hearing it because some days I do better than others. Could this affect a change positively in your walk with God? I hope so. The more days we wake up with thoughts of God, the more godly we will become. And again, it was David Kidner who pointed out something interesting. The Psalms, so often, as Jesus says in Luke 24, the Psalms were predictive of Him and His work and His salvation. So often the Psalms are a lens as they focus through the life of David or another one of its authors, that ultimately there is a greater intention for these thoughts that encompass the Messiah who was coming and His glorious reign. And he makes an observation that perhaps this phrase, "when I awake," speaks to a greater moment than the coming of a new day of our lives here. But perhaps it anticipates when our sleep gives rise to the resurrection, and when we gloriously awaken one day to the very real and awesome and filling presence of our God. That, my friend and neighbor, is where all of this is going. And are you ready for the resurrection day? By first being raised to walk with Him who died for you. Do you believe in Him? Do you believe in Him with all your heart? As much fun as I'm going to have this week spending time with Michaela and Claire and Mike and Carol, I still wouldn't have just come 700 miles or however far it is from Houston to do this work. I could have just planned a vacation to come see my friends. But I've come all this way because I believe with 100% of my heart that the King reigns. And that I need Him. And that you need Him. And that I should turn from vain things to serve a living and true God. Sin that is injurious to me. Sin that is harmful to my life and soul, that I should turn from a futile way of life, and that I should with my lips employ what God has created with me in this special design, that I should use my lips and my tongue to give praise to God, because one day every tongue shall give praise to God. Every tongue will acknowledge who He is, and that He is the King. But if you wait, it could be too late. And perhaps there is one who believes those things and knows that coming into union with Christ involves a baptism on the basis of who God is, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, coming into union with Him to rise, to walk to a better, more fulfilling, cheerful life. If we can assist you tonight, come while we stand and while we sing.